Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday morning, and we are so happy to have James Marone as our guest again. It's an encore performance from James Marone. First, let me thank everybody who pledged. Today's a day off for us, which is marvelous because you pledged, and so we got to take another day off our pledge drive, which means we have more time to talk with James about his new book, which is just very, very good and has been getting rave reviews all around the country. James is the co-author of The Heart of Power, Health and Politics in the Oval Office, and it looks at how presidents from 75 years ago until now have focused on the issue of health care reform. Some have been able to make major changes. Others have tweaked the system. Others have tried and then said, this is something I can't do, and so they've abandoned health care reform. It's really an excellent history. And he is also the author of 8 books, The Democratic Wish, Hellfire Nation, which was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. He has published hundreds of articles and essays, including regular contributions to the American Prospect and the London Review of Books, and occasional op-eds in the New York Times. He says his very favorite essay draws political lessons from Harry Potter. He's testified before Congress many times, most recently during the orientation for newly elected members in January of 2009. Although my information might be a little outdated, he probably has testified on health care since then. He says, though, and this is great, he is proudest of his teaching awards voted by the Brown classes of 1993, 99, 2001, 2007, and 2008. And he is a professor of political science and urban studies at Brown. Here's our phone number. Because we're pledge-free today, we'll have more time to take phone calls, and I guarantee you we'll take them early in the show. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. And if you would like to send an email, you could do that. That's talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. Professor James Marone, thank you so much for joining us again.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi. Thanks for having me back. It's great to be back on the show.
Nice to have you here. You're a fabulous guest. Yesterday, we were talking about healthcare. We've been doing a series of programs on healthcare in various countries, and we were looking at Finland yesterday, which has an interesting system. The guest had spent time teaching and studying in the United States, and he said that there was a different kind of relationship, that there was more trust that the government would do the right thing in Finland than there is in the United States. Do we suffer and have presidents, when they've tried to make reforms, suffer from a lack of trust?
Oh, yes, I think very much so. I think right from the start, the idea of the government getting their hands on your health care has been a huge issue. The when Harry Truman first proposed national health insurance, right in the height of the Red Scares, immediately the cry went out about socialism. And at the same time in Europe, why, there were socialist parties in most countries. So this whole idea that goes right back to the American Revolution, that the government is not ourselves acting together, it's really a foreign entity, has made this a much more contentious, difficult issue on all sides. I was just talking to someone who went to teach in Denmark, not Finland, but Denmark, and when you sign up for your Social Security card in Denmark, they give you a list of doctors, and they say, here, pick a doctor. And that's just how you sign up for taking a job in Denmark. These countries have a very different view of government. And the great irony, Kathleen, is that when we actually pass programs that use government, Social Security, Medicare, programs, Medicaid even, they become very popular programs. So it's not that Americans only distrust their government, it's that we have a very, very complicated relationship with authority.
Mm-hmm. Tell me if you think the healthcare debate is changing a little bit. It doesn't seem to be as nasty. We're not hearing as many cries right now of socialism. What's going on?
Boy, this has been really interesting. We knew that after the summer, the scene was going to change. We had think of it as a play, and the scene in the summer is back to the people. And what we saw was very interesting, this rise of what you have to call very conservative populism, the "we hate the government" populism, and that became a, you know, a kind of picture of this very anti-governmental, but very intensely felt. I think it's unfair to call it AstroTurf. People felt very strongly about a number of issues, which we can talk about. Now the scene changes. Curtain goes down, curtain goes back up, and now we're in the bowels of Congress. And now it's all about negotiations between individual members. And the whole town hall meeting business kind of dissipates. And something we all knew, that this was going to be a test for something the Obama people have not been really tested on, which is how good are they in making the case, not in public, where they frankly didn't do a very good job, but in small groups in Congress. And I think what they've managed to do is get their eye back on the ball. So the debate has now become, in Congress, not about, oh, my God, we hate government, but about, okay, we've got some problems. Can we come together and figure out a way to really address these problems? And I think, Kathleen, one way to think about this is the Democratic Party essentially got this message. All right, we made you the majority, which means we elected liberals, moderates, conservatives. You guys run the spectrum. If you can't decide within your own party, we're going to take the keys away from you guys and give it back to the Republicans. The Democrats got that. And so they are now thinking, okay, what common ground can we meet? And it's really a test for Democrats of whether they can be a majority party. When that became the conversation, some Republicans at least began to think, we might want to get in on this story. So the whole temperature of the debate went down. Although I think when it gets to the floor, we'll see some more fireworks. So if you really like your politics with fire, don't worry, you'll get some more of that too.
When's that going to happen? When's it on the floor?
In the next couple of weeks. The House is all set to take it to the floor. They'll have to take it to the Rules Committee, because in Congress, which is the most complicated legislative machine in the world, in the House, you get separate rules, literally separate rules, for every single piece of legislation. So the Rules Committee will say, here are the rules that we're going to debate this bill under. How long do we have the debate? How many minutes can each member speak? It's all, they're just going to write the rules for this. But the House wants to wait. There's something in Congress called BTU'd, being BTU'd. And what it means is this. It's an inside congressional thing. When Clinton was president, he forced the Democrats to vote for a tax on British thermal units. It's an energy tax. They said, this is going to kill us back home. And Clinton said, no, we need it. We need it for the environment. We need it for the deficit. The House went, and then the Senate said, we're not going to do that. And they stripped it out of the bill. And so the House members got pummeled for voting for something that never even came up to the Senate. So the House is now, we're not so sure we want to go until the Senate is ready to go also. So we don't have to walk the plank on things that aren't even going to come up in the Senate. Mm-hmm. Having said that, in the next couple of weeks, the House is going to go. And then once the Senate Finance Committee votes the bill out of the Senate Finance Committee, then there will be two bills in the Senate. Are you following this?
Yes,
it's complicated.
I got you.
Two bills in the Senate. Harry Reid is going to have to get the chairman of the two committees together, make it one bill, then bring it to the floor, I guess in about 2 weeks.
Oh, my gosh. It'll be a fascinating
It'll
2 weeks.
Be fun.
Yeah. What about, a lot of your book deals with presidential leadership on this particular issue. It seems to me, and tell me if you have a different perception, that Obama doesn't get his eye on the ball sometimes until he knows he has to. I noticed that in his campaign. It looked like he was kind of, a little slow with some things, and then this full court press at the end. Tell me if you think he has handled this, if it would have been different, if right at the beginning, because he had all this political capital, people were loving him, it was this huge, important, historic election, if he had just said, this has got to happen, this is a big part of my administration, it's who I am, let's get health care for everybody.
Obama is the tortoise. We didn't know this, but it's just as you said, in the election, and he says this, he said in the election, there were times when everybody was panicked, and I'm just steady as she goes kind of guy. So the soaring rhetoric sometimes misleads people on Obama, but he's the tortoise, slow and steady wins the race. That said, I think actually he went as fast as he could. See, he originally tasked Tom Daschle to get this thing through, and Tom Daschle, the former majority leader in the Senate, crashed and burned because of a tax problem. So all of a sudden, his leadership on health disappeared. And there was a meeting in the White House in which the economics team said, all right, we got to just forget health care. And Obama said no, and I think rightly said no. It's almost as if he read our book. If we don't get it as quickly as possible, we'll never get it. Given the Daschle troubles, I think he's gone as fast as he can go. And the real question is, how good is he at twisting those arms behind closed doors? And, you know, one mark of someone who's doing it well is you don't hear anything about it, Kathleen. Mm-hmm. And that really is striking me, that we've heard very few people run for the microphones. And, you know, in the Senate, they always say when you're in the Senate chambers, the most dangerous places between a senator and a microphone. So the fact that they haven't been, you know, there was one case which we all, those of us trying to score this at home, were really struck by. Jay Rockefeller, a Democratic liberal senator, got very annoyed when Baucus, the Senate chair from Montana, the Senate finance chair, revealed his bill. And Rockefeller said, I could never vote for this. 6 hours later, he said, I've met with the president, and we can negotiate this. That was really something, that within a day, in less than a day, really, and within 6 hours, Obama got him to back off. That struck me as he's very quietly, maybe, seems to be negotiating pretty well behind the scenes. But we'll see a lot more of this. The more senators negotiate through the news media, the more the White House is losing control. And so far, they haven't been doing that.
Mm-hmm. Has he read your book, Obama?
You know, the rumor is that he has. It was given to him at Camp David. And one of my friends in the administration said that he visited Obama at Camp David, and when he left, there was Obama with his nose in the book.
All right.
I don't know if it was someone just being nice to me or whether it's actually true, but my co-author and I actually believe he's read it.
Yeah. Let's go to phone calls. 800-486-8655. The co-author of The Heart of Power, Health and Politics in the Oval Office is our guest, Professor James Marone. He is professor of political science and urban studies at Brown University, and we start our calls with Brad from Grand Rapids, Wisconsin. Hi, Brad.
Hey, Brad.
Hi there. I think what's different today than in years ago is that under current system, it's becoming realized that it's unsustainable fiscally. But I think this will help liberals with passing something like a Medicare for All reform. If only they would go on the media, like you mentioned, and educate the masses about its benefits and about the pitfalls of not instituting that kind of reform.
Brad, that's a really good point. And let me just make two quick comments about that. Brad is dead right, everybody. Unsustainable is just the word. And the way I would put it is this. Every 4 to 5 years, we take one penny from the economy and add it to the healthcare system. If you're in a economic green shades type, you'll just say the GDP, an extra percent of GDP of the whole economy goes to health every roughly 5 years. Well, we're not going to get to 100% health care and nothing else in this country. We're still going to, you know, have radio stations and stuff, I hope. So we sooner or later, that escalation has to stop. That makes the whole system unsustainable. But then comes the second point, single payer. I actually believe, and we can argue about this, that single payer would actually be probably the most effective cost control. And let me say once, don't say single payer, say Medicare for All if you're a supporter. The problem with Medicare for All is something else that's changed in our political system. When people are out there in the public, like you and me and everybody thinking about this, you might agree with Medicare for All. You might disagree with it. It's got some arguments, lots of arguments for it, and some arguments against it as well. Once you get into the bowels of Congress, the system has been designed – been designed now to make it impossible, so that they have rules called pay-go, which is short for pay-as-you-go. Every penny you add to any bill has to be paid for as you go by money you take out from some other legislation, from some other program, or money you raise in taxes explicitly. That has made it, and it's all scored by a bunch of nonpartisan economists. That makes it really hard to even think about single payer. So the reason single payer or Medicare for All was off the table, to the great chagrin of liberals, was not, I don't think, because the people in the Obama administration thought, well, it's too complicated to explain to the public. It really was, once you see the complicated rules in Congress, it's almost impossible to get that elephant through that particular keyhole.
And tell me, this is slightly off subject, except that this idea of Medicare for All, which a lot of people think sounds terrific, a lot of the problem here is that the issue of money, which you in your book tell this great story about Lyndon Johnson and how he just didn't want economic figures or advisors to run the bill. We now know that Medicare costs a lot of money, that it's going to face more financial problems. So we'd have to deal with that whole issue, wouldn't we? Have we dealt with that issue?
Kathleen, you're absolutely right. It's really funny. We listened to the tapes from Lyndon Johnson, but he was completely dismissive, as was Kennedy, about how much it would cost. There was one fabulous tape we heard in which he's instructing a young Ted Kennedy, just elected in 1962, and he says, if you want to get a health care bill through, don't let them project the costs out. Mm-hmm. Well, now you have to project the costs out, of course. My co-author and I believe that if we had had good cost projections, accurate cost projections, which Johnson suppressed, we would have never had Medicare. So here's one of those very difficult choices your listeners can ponder. On the one hand, Medicare has been very expensive for our healthcare system. On the other, can you imagine America without Medicare, the second most popular program? And it would be hard for people over 65 to even imagine that. Mm-hmm. So that's the great conundrum.
Yeah.
And part of why Medicare costs so much is the simple escalation in all healthcare costs. Mm-hmm. It's actually the single most effective insurance program in terms of paying less. Now, if you're a doctor, you're saying, well, I don't want to be paid less. Medicare really squeezes me,
right,
which is just the point. Medicare is actually a pretty effective cost cutter, but as long as it's on a system, which with skyrocketing costs, it's on the cost escalator. I'm mixing my metaphors, Kathleen. it's on the cost escalator like everyone else. So until we bring our costs of the system as a whole under control, Medicare will be unsustainable.
Mm-hmm. First most popular program, Social Security?
Social Security, then Medicare, and that goes year in and year out.
Let's welcome more phone calls in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. Thanks to everybody who donated online the last few days and made today another pledge-free day. That's just great. If you want to make your pledge, you could still go to WPR.org. Our guest this hour is Professor James Marone, Professor of Political Science and Urban Studies at Brown University, author most recently, and we believe that the president has read the book, The Heart of Power, Health and Politics in the Oval Office. It looks at how presidents from Harry Truman all the way through to Barack Obama, although we're living that right now, have dealt with the issue of health care and health reform. More calls in a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to phone calls now, Milton from Madison. Hello.
Hi. Both historically and today, I think we ought to look at two very important things and never leave these two things out of any discussion on health care, and that's polls and playing field. There's a mantra that it goes through the media constantly that Americans don't understand single payer and they don't want single payer and they're suspicious of single payer. But every single-payer poll that I can find shows overwhelming support for single-payer, not only among the citizens, but among medical people as well. And then, which brings us to our other part of the playing field. The people who deliver our health care, the real people who deliver our health care, are in favor of single payer, but their bosses are not. And their bosses, big medicine, big pharma, big insurance, who got the trillion-dollar bailout, who got trillions of dollars from our government recently in bailout, they don't want it. And they spend quite a lot of money to make sure we don't get a balanced discussion.
It's one of the most interesting things is how physicians have changed. They used to hate the idea. They fought Medicare tooth and nail. And now it is the most interesting difference is how a lot of physicians are beginning to say, or not beginning to say, a lot of physicians are saying, look, stop the insurance company bugging me. I want to fire my 10 people in the billing office of my little practice. Just let me practice medicine. And if that means giving me an annual fixed rate, I'll take it. So there's a wonderful study that makes this point. A guy named Dr. Kane from the University of Minnesota went to a Canadian hospital and said, let me talk to your billing department. And he was introduced to three or four people, and they said, yeah, we bill the provincial government. And he's had lunch with them, and very nice. And then he went to a hospital in Michigan, right across the river, and he said, let me see your billing department. And he was shown a whole wing of 140 people, all of whom had to bill the various insurance companies. Mm. So the basic logic behind single payer is, look, let's close down that wing, give the hospitals a fixed amount of money, and say, here, guys, do your best. Next year, we'll give you another amount of money. So that's the kind of logic, and it's really becoming very desirable to a lot of physicians. Just get the insurance companies out of my face. I have to negotiate over every single bill I submit. But playing field is right. I mean, the polls are ambiguous, I would say. I slightly disagree. I think a lot of people support single payer. When you actually get into the details, it's not clear to me that the people would support it. I don't know, is all I'm saying, whether the support would sustain itself once we got into the actual debate. But as I said, Congress is designed not to do single payer. You'd really have to change the rules mm-hmm. by which Congress plays.
Mm-hmm. Can you give us a little bit more of a historical perspective? He brought up pharmaceuticals and insurance companies. What's been the influence historically of those industries in terms of fashioning healthcare, in terms of opposing healthcare? Have they always been strong?
You know, it's so interesting. When Harry Truman first proposed national health insurance, there essentially wasn't a private sector. It was very small. And one of Truman's lines was, if the government doesn't do this, no one will do it. Dwight Eisenhower succeeded, a Republican, succeeded Harry Truman. He was a wonderful guy, incidentally. We read the notes he used to write to his subordinates, and he was really, he cared about them. He'd say things like, you're working too hard, I want you to take 5 days off, and don't take your briefcase with you. And he said over and over again, if we don't build a private insurance system, the government is going to end up paying for all of health care. And it was the Eisenhower administration that really nailed into place something that was already around from World War II, but that was the tax break that employers got to provide health insurance to their employees. The Eisenhower Republicans pushed that very hard as an alternative to socialized medicine. So when they took over, it was a very small percentage of the population that had private insurance. By the end of the Eisenhower years, that is from 53 to January 1961, by the end of those years, thanks to a big concerted push from the administration, most large companies were offering private health insurance. So it was something new, and it was designed originally as an alternative to government health care. And it got more and more influential and more powerful over the years as health inflation took off. At first, the insurance companies went, there are a bunch of guys, and they'd figure out how much it costs, and they'd send the premiums to the employers, and the employers would pay the premiums, and it was no big deal. The cost just got passed through. As costs rose year after year, and really beginning in the 1980s, the insurance companies became the arbiters of trying to do something about healthcare costs. They became very large as the whole healthcare sector grew. So by the 80s and the 90s, they were these huge, very wealthy, very powerful players. But they're relatively new as power players. In the original days of health insurance, it was doctors, government, and citizens. And that was pretty much it. And now we have this huge group of very powerful players, the insurance company, probably more than any of them.
And tell me, Jim, how actively are they lobbying right now? What are they doing?
Oh, they're all over this.
They're all over.
All over it. But something very interesting here. We've sent a signal. You know, you design a system, and we've designed a system that says to the insurance companies, what we're saying is we want you to offer the best product at the lowest price. What we're actually telling you by the incentives in the system is, hey, guys, you want to make a lot of money? Avoid sick people. If you get sick people in your insurance, in your plan, you're going to be a loser. If you duck sick people, you'll be a winner. That's how we've organized the system, so that insurance companies have gotten very, very good at what they call risk management. Old people, chronically ill people, poor people, people who aren't part of large young groups. Avoid all those folks because they're more likely to be sick. And we've organized a system that sends those incentives to the insurance companies. Some of the insurance companies know, they know that that system can't survive. So their idea is, look, change the playing field. We can still win, but give us new incentives. The large insurance companies know that with those new incentives, they can wipe out the little guys. So they actually want better rules. Now, I know I sound like I'm just talking for the insurance companies, but whether you're liberal or conservative, I think, and you look at the system, what you'll find is, one, we've designed a horrible set of incentives
right.
in our insurance system. And two, the big insurance companies could actually win with a better set of incentives. Mm. They could wipe out the marginal insurance players. So they're actually in this to make the system a little better now, because they know the whole thing could collapse and we will get single payer if it doesn't get fixed now.
Interesting. Well, you got to wonder, because whatever your political persuasion, most of us, if we're lucky, do get old, we all get sick. And to have a system, it's just wacky, where you win if you don't insure people who are sick when you're in the business of health care, just it blows the mind in a way.
That's one of the things that's really been lost in this debate. There's one school of thought that says, why should healthy people subsidize sick people? But you get to be a certain age and you realize we're all sick, we're all going to get sick, we're all going to die. The basic logic of insurance is, hey, we're all in this together, and we've got to watch out for one another. I think that's just one of those basic fundamentals of life, like being born and dying.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, underneath all the politics, this is about the basic truth of the human condition.
Yeah. Thanks, Milton, for your call. Bill is next from Tomahawk. Hi, Bill.
Oh, hi. Thanks for getting me on. My observation is this. The people that are designing health care policy in the United States all have health care, and they're designing health care policy for those of us that don't. And they don't really understand the problem, and that starts with Congress, who's well-insured. And, you know, how can we expect these people to begin to understand the problem?
That's Bill, that's absolutely true. I thought there was a marvelous moment in Obama's press conference when someone said, will you live with the health insurance plan that you're proposing? And Obama laughed, and to his credit, I thought, he was perfectly honest. He said, I'm the president of the United States. There's a doctor within 20 feet of me at all times.
Right.
You know, we're not all going to get that. The original Democratic plan and the original Democratic slogan was every American deserves the same health plan that Congress gets. And somewhere in the fire of the last 4 or 5 months, that got lost. But the original conception of the Obama people was exactly that. Give the American people the exact same health plan as Congress people have. But I think Bill's making a really deep point, which is there's not an understanding, I think, among the well-insured about just how hard this is for people who are scraping by to find a way to get insurance. It's shocking, really, and people don't get it in their bones. That got lost in the debate in the spring and the summer, just how tough it is if you're not part of a group.
Thanks, Bill, for your call. Mike from Appleton, hi.
Yeah, this is such a complicated issue, but trying to approach it from a simplistic point, two ideas. It would seem to me that on any given day in any given doctor's office, let's say that there's 10 people. Of those 10 people, let's say 3 are in Medicare and 7 are in private insurance. What's happening is that the private insurance payers are subsidizing the cost of the doctor of the people who are on Medicare. So, you know, if that, I think that's a fact. The other part, this idea of single payer, I mean, it all sounds to me like we're going to get these homogenized doctors who all work for the government. Man, I don't know. You're taking away the incentive. You know, people go into medicine for a lot of different reasons, but one is obviously the financial gains that they have, and I want the doctor who operates on my brain to be extremely well paid and to be the best there is. Am I going to get that under this new, you know, kind of universal system?
Mike, you're pretty sophisticated, despite what you said at the outset. The system is rife, essentially, with cross-subsidies. And you're absolutely right. The 7 people, and you got the figures right, too, the 7 people in the doctor's office who are on private insurance are subsidizing the 3 who are on Medicare. But, on the one hand, we keep saying, hey, we got to have cost control. We can't keep growing the healthcare system relative to the rest of the economy. On the other hand, we keep saying, well, but we don't want, you know, real cost control. Sooner or later, we're going to have to do for the entire system what we're doing for Medicare, which is putting the brakes on. And that's going to happen. We're not going to get to 100% the whole economy just on medicine. We can't keep sending an extra penny of every dollar we spend every 5 years to medicine. So the question is, how do we do it? It's a pretty striking, sobering reminder that Medicare's actually been a pretty good cost control mechanism, because if you're paying private insurance and the insurance company wants to raise premiums, they simply raise the premiums. Nothing you can do about it. When Medicare wants to raise its premiums, it goes to Congress and says, could you raise taxes? Congress says, oh, no, we're not going to do that. We'll find a way to cut Medicare costs. That's why Medicare, and by extension, single payer, is thought by many people to be a tough cost control. But we can't have both cost control and endless escalation of doctors' fees. Single payer really would look like the Medicare program. So if you think Medicare is homogenized or flawed in some way, then you're against single payer. If you think Medicare is the best insurance program in the country, then it doesn't make sense to oppose single payer. You're basically for it. But study Medicare. There's things to like and things to dislike. And imagine everybody in the country on it. And then figure, well, is this something I'd like or something I don't like? That'll tell you whether you're a single payer advocate.
Thanks, Mike, for the call. We'll take more in a moment. Our guest this hour, and we happen to have a pledge-free hour. Thanks to you, we will probably resume pledge tomorrow. Resume. We haven't had it yet. We'll start pledge tomorrow, but we already have had great success with You're Just Going to WPR.org. Thanks so much. Our guest this hour is the author of The Heart of Power, Health and Politics in the Oval Office. James Marone is with us. He is a professor of political science, urban studies at Brown University. The book traces how presidents back to Harry Truman until now have dealt with the issue of health care reform or have not done so. So we have a couple lines open for the first time, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program this Wednesday, we'll be talking about home foreclosures. The problem is getting worse in the United States from July of 2008 to July of 2009. The filings increased by 32%. Our guest says there is a double trigger theory of foreclosures, which applies in the current environment, and the available data suggests there is an increase in foreclosures in the immediate future. He has some very interesting solutions, so we'll talk about that issue, hour number two. Joining us this hour, encore performance from James Marone, co-author of The Heart of Power, Health and Politics in the Oval Office. And let's go to Gary from DePere. Hi, Gary.
Hi. See, everybody keeps talking about Medicare all the time, like it's a solution. It only pays for 80% of whatever's allowed. My mother is on Medicare, and she has a supplement, too, from Blue Cross. And her entire medical costs are premiums per year with Blue Cross and her Medicare deduction is about $4,000, and she's 93. So better rethink the idea of Medicare being for all. Sounds good, but it's not as cheap as, you know, you might want to think.
There's a couple of problems with Medicare, and they're really worth, I'm glad you brought them up. One is, it's just really complicated. The guy who wrote the bill and designed the forms, a fellow named Wilbur Cohen, as an old man, he returned to Congress with all the paperwork Medicare had sent him, and he said, I can't figure this out. I wrote the bill, and I can't fill out all these forms. Can't you simplify? And the answer is, they haven't. They've made it more and more complicated. So if I were ruling the world, the first thing I'd do is just simplify things. It's baffling for elders to negotiate the Medicare program. Secondly, as healthcare costs continue to rise, and as Congress, of course, doesn't want to raise taxes to pay for it, we've shoved more and more of the costs of Medicare onto the Medicare beneficiaries. And we've never been able to get a cap on catastrophic costs. So there's no upper limit on the amount you can spend if you're consuming a lot of health care. So one of the previous callers, Mike, said he wants a really well-paid doctor to pay for his brain surgery. Well, someone's going to have to pay that really well-paid doctor, and that's your mother who's paying for it. So when we say we're getting costs, we've got to get costs under control. Part of it is we have to get costs under control because we're paying for this. And Medicare over the years has gotten, first, more complicated, and secondly, the benefits have eroded as more and more costs have been shoved onto the individual beneficiary. So that if you don't have a Medigap, that is a supplemental private insurance on top of Medicare, you could run up substantial costs. And that's true for private insurance policies as well. It's really hurting the individual, and until we get overall costs under control, that's going to get worse.
Mm-hmm. Let's address the money issue just a little bit more. I'm hearkening back to Finland because it's top of mind, and our guest was saying that doctors don't make nearly the amount of money, but it doesn't mean really that doctors in Finland aren't just as good as many doctors in the United States are in their particular specialties. It's just sort of the American way, isn't it? If you have a lot of college, if you're doing some, well, not for all jobs, because some jobs don't pay much and they're very important, but there's a difference in the way we want money, and I'm wondering if that's a huge part of healthcare reform here, that people who are in the profession, particularly specialists, are making too much money, are they?
Specialists make a lot of money, although I'll tell you, I was in a debate with the vice president of the American Medical Association and various other people, insurance company executives and so forth, and there was a medical school student who got up and said, when I listen to this debate, I just don't want to go into medicine anymore. It just sounds like you've made it horrible, the practice of medicine. And this vice president, a guy named Dr. Todd, he got up and said, look, at the end of the day, when I look in the mirror, even though I'm now a bureaucrat, what looks back in from my mirror is a healer, is someone who tries to heal people. And I spend one day a week seeing patients because that's who I am and that's what I love. And I think that's what you want from your doctors, people who really, and you know, we all know people like that, who are really committed to their patients and work day in and day out, not because they want the second Maserati, but because they're healers.
Right.
And, you know, the medical profession has really changed. It's now almost half women. Women come at medicine, and it's a gross generalization, but the people going into medicine today, I see it in med school all the time, have very different attitudes. They don't expect that by the time they're old doctors, 30, 40 years from now, that this is going to be a huge, high-paid profession. They understand that, I think, for the most part, that the profession is changing, and they're drawn to it by something, I think, many of them, much more noble than just big cars and nice boats.
Right. Oh, yeah, you'd have to. It's a grueling life.
Grueling.
It's a very, very hard life, I think. Tell me, what do you think is likely to be passed now, Jim?
You know, that's the great question, Kathleen.
I don't know.
I think I've got it. It's 95% that the Democrats will pass something. And I think it's about 55% that they'll pass something really significant.
Really?
Everybody, yes. It's now, you know, in the bowels of Congress. But people are missing, I think, the crucial dimension. To me, the crucial dimension of all this is not the public option, which is important and has drawn a lot of fire, but it's the subsidy to help people buy insurance. If there's a large subsidy, now in that, the plan has a subsidy to help people buy insurance. It's got a public option. It's got insurance market reforms that we've talked about, and it's got other changes meant to make the medical system more efficient, like high-tech stuff. So those are the four things in the bill. The great secret for liberals who'd like real national health insurance is the subsidy for people to help people buy private insurance. That is, when you go buy private insurance, if you're below a certain income threshold, you'll get a tax break to help you buy that insurance. That's a huge hidden social welfare program. It doesn't look like social welfare because it's run through the tax system. But Democrats learned during the Reagan years that if you run your programs through the tax system, no one calls them welfare. This is a dirty, rotten secret. Don't tell anybody I'm telling you this because it's gone under the radar screen. But look, if we said everybody up to 200% of poverty is going to get a big break on buying private health insurance, you've just passed a huge, huge program, and no one even notices because it's running through the tax system. If, on the other hand, we said everybody up to 90% of poverty, that is, you're still under the poverty line, then it's not very significant, then not very many people are going to qualify. So the thing to watch is who qualifies for the subsidy to buy health insurance. And if it's very generous, and some versions of this bill would make it very generous, some would make it very stingy. If it's very generous, the Democrats and Obama in particular have managed to slip through a very powerful program while everybody was screaming about public option.
Oh, that's interesting. Our attention hasn't been drawn to that at all.
No, and I hesitate to say anything even, but I know this is Wisconsin and everybody has and surrounding areas, and you all care about good policies, whether you're Democrats or Republicans up there. But I would not say this in some other parts of the country.
You're funny. All right, thanks very much for your call. Let's go next to Ann from Madison. Hi, Ann.
Hi. I kind of wanted to respond to what Mike said earlier about the three people on Medicare being subsidized by the seven people in private health care. Mm-hmm. And I was going to say, isn't there one or two other people that are left out of that don't have insurance, and they're subsidizing both groups because many of them are paying taxes, and many of them are sick, and so they're not drawing money out of the private health care system because they can't get insurance.
I'm so glad you said that, Anne. I didn't have time to say that in my answer, but you're right. Depending on the neighborhood, one, two, or three of those 10 people don't have insurance or don't have enough insurance. On average, it's going to be something like three of those people. And they're coming to the doctor, and they're saying, we can't pay, but we're hurting. And that doctor, their doctor is likely to be a hospital, which is very expensive, and someone has to pay for them as well. You're absolutely right, and that's an important addition. So those 10 people in the medical system, three are on Medicare, four have good private health insurance, and something like three don't have enough health insurance. And we ought to say this. The gold standard on the uninsured is the Institute of Medicine study, which suggests that 18,000 people a year die who wouldn't die if they had better health insurance. So, it's a remarkable, painful figure that we've got of people who are really not only being paid for the, by the rest of us for some medicine, but not getting enough, and in 18,000 cases a year, it's an estimate, you can argue about it, but something like 18,000 people a year are actually dying because we either give them not enough health care or the intervention comes too late.
Thanks, Ian, for your call. Let's go to Phil next from Kenosha. Hi, Phil.
Hi, my question is, are there going to be rules in place to prevent abuse? As a manager of a restaurant, I'd have an employee on the public option who would go in 3-4 times a month with sniffles just to get out of work. She'd get her transportation paid for, and we're paying for all of that. And then at the end of the year, she would still get $5,000-$7,000 back in taxes as well because of all the children she had.
This is always an issue. Every time health reform comes up, there's this full range of people. There's some people who are really sick, who have cancer, who have all kinds of illnesses. And as Kathleen said earlier, we're all going to have something like that, hopefully later rather than sooner. But there are all kinds of other people who are using the healthcare system for other things. Hopefully not too many are using it just to get out of working for you. But there's psychological problems. There are people who think they have illnesses they don't really have. So it's, you know, medicine is the full human condition. And the question is, how do we set up a set of incentives? And who do we incentivize to cover everyone and yet still think, look, this person isn't sick. They're a hypochondriac. I know a few of those myself. I'm a chairman of a political science department, I can tell you. And a few people who, the papers do, and all of a sudden they discover they have to go to the infirmary. And there's lots of ways. Every healthcare plan and every healthcare system has to think about how to take care of those problems. And the single payer, I'll just give you one example, since so many people have been calling about single payer. The classic case, this would happen in Finland, it's a European answer. It says, put all that in the doctor's hands. Give the doctor a fixed amount of money. HMOs do that too, this too in the United States, by the way. Give the physician a fixed amount of money, give the hospital a fixed amount of money, and say, look, you decide. We can't decide. I can't tell you which student is really sick and which is just trying to get out of a term paper. But let the doctor decide. They've only got a fixed amount of money. And if the same person, your employee, is coming back week after week just to get out of work, that doctor's saying, look, I got finite resources. I'm not gonna keep seeing you. I got other people to see. There are other ways to incentivize, but that has probably been the most successful. Put these decisions back in the hands of the hospital and of the healthcare system.
Thanks so much for your call. Here's an email. Isn't the cost of medical education in this country a major problem relative to those countries that have a single payer or other universal forms of insurance that successfully keep costs down? What can be done about this problem?
There's a couple of problems in the medical system. Three, we mentioned. One is the cost of medical education. It's very high. If Congress had to raise taxes every time they wanted to, if Congress were paying for this, they would squeeze medical education. That might be good, it might be bad, but it would cut costs. Second, you didn't mention this in the email, and I'm surprised no doctor has written in, but the doctors will always tell you the cost of lawsuits lead them to practice very careful medicine. Every study suggests this is exaggerated, but I've never talked to a doctor who agrees with that. So we really don't know how much lawsuits and the threat of lawsuits drive all this. And third, another thing that's really driving costs is technology. Well, you know, if there's a new technology out there, it spreads through the American system very, very quickly, and the rest of the world sits back and says, let's see if this works. And if it works well, they'll adopt it more slowly. If it doesn't work well, they'll say, well, good, we're glad that the Americans tried it out for us. So all three of those things drive costs a lot: medical education, lawsuits, technology. But there's a fourth thing, and that is we pay our providers more than other people in other countries pay. For anything you name, we pay more than other countries do.
Right. We have about 30 seconds left, so it's going to have to be brief. Saeed from Green Bay. Hi.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to make a comment about Medicare. Your speaker mentioned that if you think Medicare is a good insurance, then you're for a single provider. But there's an assumption there that isn't correct, and that is that Medicare, if it was the only provider, would look like Medicare looks today. Medicare is bankrupt and is subsidized, as your speaker mentioned, subsidized by private insurance. If that private insurance wasn't there to defray the costs, Medicare would not look like it does today.
All right, we have about 15 seconds.
Yes, you know, that's right as far as it goes. If we had a system in which the government, the Congress constantly had to make the following decision, people are screaming about health care costs, we have to put more money into the system, versus we have to pay for it directly by raising taxes. That would be an honest, direct choice. Right now, we're hiding those choices and just letting the costs escalate. Medicare for All would make those trade-offs. Better medicine, more taxes. It would make that trade-off explicit.
Thank you, Jim, so much for being with us.
Oh,
you're just
great,
a great
fun
guest.
As always, and what interesting and thoughtful calls.
Yes, aren't they good? Thank you. Professor James Marone, his author of The Heart of Power, Health and Politics in the Oval Office, professor of political science and urban studies at Brown. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, to Rob Schroeder for on-air production. Thanks for all of your calls. We'll return following the news.